You know, James, I've talked in previous classes about how James, in my opinion, does a really good job of presenting both sides of the issues. He talks about things that are problems. He talks about ways to deal with those. That's what makes the book so practical and makes it so good for us. And as we've gone throughout this class, I have tried to put a slide up every week that kind of summarized what that particular lesson was about in just kind of common language. Trying to mimic James's style by talking about the problems that we have and the way to deal with them. I had this slide last week and I did not put it up. I don't remember either. I just ran out of time or something, but I thought I would throw it back up there this week to kind of segue into today's class. Satan does not mind us being good people as long as we depend only on ourselves. And God wants us to do the right thing for the right reason all the time. Have respect for the cross. As we ended last week's class, we stopped with chapter 4, verse 17, to those that know to do good and don't, it is a sin. And I went through a description or a discussion that Brother Guy N. Woods gave in his commentary on the book of James that I want to go back to be able to segue into today's class, because I didn't do it justice. I kind of was running out of time, and I briefly went through it. Brother Woods was educated as a lawyer and was licensed to practice law in Tennessee and Texas, although to my knowledge he never did. And so when he took the 17th verse of chapter 4, to those that know to do good and don't, it is a sin, he went back to the parable of the talents. If you've got Matthew chapter 20, or if you've got your Bibles and you want to turn to Matthew chapter 25, you can go back there and read that parable. We know it pretty well. There was, you know, a five-talent guy and a two or three-talent guy, and then there was the one-talent guy. And the one-talent guy was described later in the latter parts of that parable as a wicked and slothful servant. And I use the old King James, slothful. I think your new King James says wicked and lazy. But that whole picture of a sloth just rings in my head when I think about how he's describing that one-talent man. Maybe you saw the movie Zootopia. Did you ever see the Disney movie Zootopia? Well, the sloths are really funny in that. Funny and really slow. To imagine calling that one-talent man wicked and lazy, and how do we think of a wicked person? When you describe someone as being wicked in today's time, do you think of someone who's just a bump on a log? No. I mean, when we have those kind of friends, we say, well, he's not much, but he's my friend, you know? He's not much, but he's just that bump on the log. He's a good bump. And that's not what Brother Woods says about this, because going back to the legal part of it, he says that if he were to judge the fitness for heaven of that one-talent man, he believes an excellent defense could be made for that one-talent man, because he was not an embezzler. He did not squander his money in riotous living. He was not remiss in the trust that he owed his master, because when his master returned, he gave him his one talent back. He was not a drunkard. He was not a thief. He was not an immoral person. And he was not a murderer. All those things that he was not. And then Brother Woods caps that by saying, Brother Woods doesn't believe that even if he had a jury of Christians, he doesn't believe that he believes that the jury would find in favor of the one talent man. Just how we look at that. We don't think about having those abilities and talents and not using them and that being a sin, but that's certainly what James points to. In chapter 5, well, let me put it this way. Chapter 4, now back to James. Chapter 4, verse 17, James is really clear that we have a responsibility to do the right thing. And if we look at the whole book, if we look at especially chapter 2, when James talks about being a doer and not just a hearer, does that bring chapter 4, verse 17 into focus? And I think it does. Let's go to chapter 5, verses 1 through 12 in this morning's lesson. Verses 1 through 6, and I've titled the lesson, Give Me Patience and Give It to Me Now. Verses 1 through 6 has to do with who or what is the center of our universe, and then verses 7 through 12 deal specifically with patience and long-suffering based on the events that are taking place to these Christians in verses 1 through 6. Verses 1 through 6 are a continuation of chapters 2, 3, and 4, where we talked about partiality to the visitors, where we talked about earthly wisdom and heavenly wisdom, where we talked about praying for ourselves to the exclusion of others, where we talked about leaving God out of our planning. In chapter 2, when we looked at that section about being a hypocrite, the issue was that visitors were coming into the worship service, and those visitors were dressed in fine apparel. They obviously had a lot. And the Christians there showed them preference as opposed to the ones who came in not looking so good. Those people that we talked about in chapter 2 that came into the church and expected that preferential treatment are probably the same people that we're talking about in the first six verses of chapter 5. Because we have this issue in these verses with these wealthy, non-Christian, Jewish landowners. And that's who that we're talking about in the first six verses of chapter 5. In James chapter 2, verse 4, talking about this discussion, go back there for a second, James says, "Have you not shown partiality amongst yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" Well, what did we talk about last week in chapter 4? We talked about not just gossiping, but speaking evil of one another, and that speaking evil, that slander, caused us to be judges. And in doing so, we put ourselves above God, we put ourselves above the law, we became God, we made that judgment that we don't have the right to do. And James was talking about these people in chapter 2. They come in, they oppress you, they blaspheme Jesus, and we show them to a seat of honor, and it should not be so. And those same people now are showing back up in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Most of the time, in this particular part, or in this particular time setting in the first century, and with the exception of the area directly around Jerusalem, most of the common day labor was done by slaves. In the case of the Judea area in Palestine, a lot of the work was done by hired servants. They were paid a daily wage. Verse 4, chapter 5, verse 4 talks about those hired servants. And the people that they worked for would apparently come to the worship service, and they would treat them at the worship service the same way that they treated them on the job. There are some who also take the first six verses of James as being prophetic towards the destruction of Jerusalem in a few years. And we're not going to go there because I don't believe that's what the first six verses are talking about. And the sources that I trust don't believe that either. This is talking about judgment. When James is talking to these rich landowners and he's talking about the bad things they've done to the people who work for them, he's not talking about things that are going to happen a few years later when Jerusalem is overthrown in AD 70. When we get to that point, who suffers just as much as those rich landowners do? The poor. Everyone suffers in AD 70. So it's much more likely that James is talking about the final judgment when he talks to these people and takes them to task for their attitude. He also mentions in verse 6, when he says, "You've murdered the just." And we'll get to that and spend a little time on it later. But could that be Jesus that he's talking about? Or is it just a generic just and righteous person? I believe it's probably Jesus that he's talking about in verse 6. So when he's talking to these rich landowners. He's talking to them about not just taking advantage of the people that work for them, but a pattern of behavior that has existed for the last 30 plus years, because these same class of people killed Jesus, put him on the cross. Let's look at chapter 5, verse 1 through 6. "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of the Sabbath. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you." What kind of dangers are there in trusting in riches? And I want to emphasize, this is going right back to, it's not the money that's the evil, but it's the love of money that is the root of all evil. Yes? I mean, when we put our trust in things that are physical, that are earthly, what do we end up with? He says, "Come now, weep and howl." What miseries? Well, if only I had a bigger house, right? If only I had another car. If only I had an X number of whatever in order to get me through. Is that what James is talking about? The danger of trusting in those things? You take out a dollar bill and what's on it? And who do we trust? You take out a coin. Well, you may or may not take out a coin. We don't have them anymore, it seems like. And engraved on it is, "In God we trust." What's on the hearts of these people that he's talking about in verses 1 through 6? In me do I trust. And that's what his point is in this first verse. You know, there are, I'll talk about this a couple of times in this morning's class. Debbie and I used to be in a business where the service that we provided was to what you would consider be the upper, I guess, class, or the higher socioeconomic rung on the ladder. And I've seen firsthand that those who have a lot, not all, but in many cases, are motivated by one thing only, and that is to have more. And it's sad. It's extremely sad when you see that type of thing, because you want to just shake them and say, there's a God. You have this because you've been blessed. You may not believe it, but that's why you have it. And it's not going anywhere with you. Why do you chase it so badly? And James just wants us to put our priorities where they should be. Put God at the top, not those things that we have, because money can't buy you everything. He talks about hoarding it in verses 2 and 3. What were the riches of the day? He talks about our wardrobe being moth-eaten. How many of us consider an important part of our portfolio to be what's in our closet? Probably not in today's time, right? We pretty much buy stuff and it wears out in a couple of weeks and we throw it away and we buy something else. When we buy some of the better stuff, we treat it nicely. Yes, you know, we take it to the cleaners and all that kind of stuff, and we put mothballs in the closet, but we don't consider it to be part of our net worth. Such was not the case in the first century. Because how did you get clothing, or fine clothing, in the first century? What did it take to get it there? How labor intensive was it? How expensive was it that you were able to get the material, that you were able to get the dyes and put the color in the material, that you have someone put the also make the thread in order to be able to sew it together and all those kind of things? And so it was an extremely expensive proposition. And when those people came in chapter 2, they came in dressed in fine apparel and with rings on every finger, etc., and so on. So it wasn't just the gold, the silver, the jewelry. It was the clothes, it was the crops, it was the livestock, it was all of that. And what does James say about all of that? The clothes are going to get tattered and torn and worn out. Moths are going to eat them. The rains can come, or the hail can come and destroy the crops. You know, disease can get into the flocks and destroy all that. He talks about the gold and silver corroding, and in strictly speaking, gold and silver doesn't rust, but it can be destroyed. It can be stolen. James is just trying to make the point, if this is what you're living for, you're living for the wrong thing. And there is an irony here, because in chapter 2, James talks about those that had taking advantage of those that did not and dragging them into court. And now in chapter 5, he's using that same courtroom terminology, and he's talking about that all those things that they had and all the stuff that made them more important was being used in court as a witness against them. So they bring in the poor person because the poor person's not doing something and that they want done, or they try to take advantage of them, but now they're in court defending their own life. And that which they depend on most, their belongings and their attitude toward their workers that we'll look at in a second of fraud, are those things that are witnessing against them when they're on trial. How do we heap up, and then James talks about heaping up the treasure. How do we heap it up, by the way? What do we do with it? We have things, and what do we do with them? Do we use them for others to help or so on? I'm sorry, somebody.
Store them up. We just store them, put them away, and don't do anything.
Just let them sit there, just for the fun of watching them. In today's society, we would get up and we would take out our phone and we would punch a couple of buttons and we would look to see what our bank balance was, right? That's not what James wants us to do. Mickey?
They've got stuff.
That's a good point. Gary's talking about it. I don't know if you could hear him or not. He's talking about the TV show American Pickers. And they go all over the country and they try to buy these things. And I didn't think about it putting the class together, but that's a perfect example of what James is talking about. Because they'll go into a barn and there'll be an old pinball machine, or there'll be an old flathead Ford, or there'll be something, and they'll want it. And the guy won't part with it, or the lady won't part with it, because of all that sentimental value. It's just there. And it's just piling on top, on top, on top. And especially vivid, thank you for the example, Gary, thinking about walking into that barn and seeing all the rust that's on that 1951 Ford truck or whatever it is that they're trying to buy. You know, it's not being used. Therefore, we go back to chapter 4, verse 17, those that know to do good and do not, it's a sin. What about gaining those riches in the wrong way? Verse 4. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. I have never worked for anyone who defrauded me. Perhaps you have. I have never been in a situation in which I was promised one wage and I was delivered a different wage. I wish that something like that never happened. And certainly when we get into one of those kind of situations, the person who's trying to take advantage of us has a responsibility not to do so. But what do you do when something like that happens? How do you deal with it? How do you handle it? How were the Christians in verses 1 through 6 handling it? You know, in verse 7 through 12, which we will get to, they weren't handling it all that well, because they were doing things and arguing with one another and grumbling and groaning and doing those type of things that James is going to talk about that they should not do. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 14 through 15. God made it clear exactly what the rules were when it came to a person who had employees, hired hands, and how we were to treat them. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 14 through 15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages, and you shall not let the sun go down, for he is poor, and he has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord, and it will be sin to you. These landowners, these Jewish landowners, who were supposed to be paying attention to this particular part of the law, were doing anything but. And it was creating problems in the church. How clear is this? And the workers' cries are heard by God, and that's what's important. I've also never been in a situation where the holding of my wages by one day would make a difference in my life. And I'm thankful for that. But what responsibility do we all have when it comes to taking care of our brothers and sisters, whether they work for us or not? Whether we have a problem not getting our wages on time today doesn't mean that someone else doesn't have a problem with it, and we need to be attuned to it and be able to help. Verse 5. The danger of only using riches for yourself. You have lived on this earth in pleasure and luxury, and you have fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. There are two sins taking place in verse 5. A useless and empty life, and then a wasteful life. And why does James say that we have done this? We have done this for the purpose of what? Just getting fat. When he talks about going to slaughter, do you know what the reference is to? How many of you are cow people? Now, I don't pretend to be, but I've stayed at Holiday Inn Express, plus I used to have a neighbor that was a cow person, and I did their taxes, so I know a little bit about how that part of it worked. What James is talking about here is that situation where you've got those cows, and you've got them in a pasture, and then you make a decision to send them to the feedlot. Do you know what happens at the feedlot? Those cows all get lined up, and don't shake your heads going, oh, this is so, I don't want to think about this. The cows don't care. Have you ever seen cows go on strike at a feedlot, by the way? They have not. They're at a trough, and they've got their face down in it, and they are eating their heart's delight. Everything is put in there, they're eating it. And they love it. They don't really care that much about how close the cow is on the left or the right, because what are they doing? Fat and happy. That's what they're doing. Nose down, eat the food, nobody's telling me it's too much. I can eat, 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 eat. But then what happens when they get up to a certain weight? Uh-oh. They get pulled out of the line and they get slaughtered. So one minute, they're in hog heaven, to borrow another farm animal and use it for a metaphor. And the next minute, they're realizing they just ate their last meal. It comes on them rather quick, doesn't it? That's what James is talking about when we're doing this thing, these things in our life today. We're not paying attention to what's going to be coming later. We're just thinking about the here and the now. And we're making ourselves fat because we're just interested in that which pleases us now today. The food, the riches, and all those other kinds of things. And then the danger of misusing those riches in verse 6. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. I happen to believe that in this particular verse, James is talking about Jesus. He's talking about you have murdered the righteous one. He's talking about a pattern of behavior that's happened for the last 30 or 40 years. But does the situation also fit if we're just applying it generically when we're saying, when you come in and you take the Christians here to court, you are abusing the righteous ones, and it does fit. But if this group of people is still doing this in James's day, it's the same group of people that was doing it in Jesus' day and made sure that they put Jesus on a cross. We are blessed with material things, and we have a responsibility to God and to our brothers and to our sisters to use that blessing properly. In verses 7 through 12, our questions about 1 through 6, I guess, our comments. In verses 7 through 12, we're looking at the impact that this behavior has had upon these Christians that James is writing to. And the encouragement is to endure without complaining, to keep on going, to not quit. Does that sound familiar as we've talked about other parts of James? Even under duress, to do it and maintain a good attitude. How hard is it to maintain a good attitude when someone is always stepping on your neck? How hard is it to maintain a good attitude when the boss always wants something more? How hard is it to maintain a good attitude, you know, when the car breaks down for the third time inside of a month and all those kind of things? Whose fault is it when we have a bad attitude? Where do we need to look when we have a bad attitude? We've talked about that in chapter 2 as well. You know, sometimes you do things, you're in a business and you try to take care of everything that you take care of and it just doesn't work. And the client that you're providing a service to just exacts a pound of flesh from you. Does that give you a reason to go about and mistreat your fellow brothers or sisters? But then why is it that we do that? That's what James is talking about. We're grumbling, we're groaning, and we're taking it out on those that we love the most. But we do, don't we? We all know that. We all do it. You know, I'm under the sink trying to tighten up the nut that on the trap to keep the water from leaking, and I bump my head and I yell at Debbie. It wasn't Debbie's fault that I bumped my head. It wasn't Debbie's fault that I raised up too quick. Why did I get mad at her? It's just kind of human nature, isn't it? We do it, and we shouldn't. Verses 7 through 12. We want to emphasize patience, and we want to emphasize endurance. James uses the word patience 4 times in verses 7, 8, and 10. And that particular word that's used is patience means long-tempered, long-suffering. In verse 11, he uses it twice, and your versions will probably may have patience there, but they may say steadfastness or they may say endurance. It's a different word in verse 11, and it means steadfast endurance. That's what James is trying to illustrate to us in verses 7 through 12. We have to be patient. We have to love one another. We have to have steadfast endurance. Remember the old Timex watches? There would be a TV commercial on and they would throw that Timex watch underneath a steamroller or something, and then John Cameron Swayze would pick it up and he'd hold it up. He says, takes a licking, keeps on ticking. That's what James is asking us to do in verses 7 through 12. Let's read it. Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming day of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and later rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another. Does anybody have a version that says grudge not? What is your version, John? King James? Is it King James? All right. I love that terminology. Grudge not. Doesn't that just say everything to you? Grudge. Just to be in a grudge. Makes me think of the guy who was up in the persimmon tree eating breakfast one day. If you don't know what a persimmon tree is, it's an extremely bitter fruit and it's not for breakfast. Grudge not. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you have seen the end intended by the Lord, and that the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, brethren, do not swear, neither by heaven or earth or with any oath, but it lets your yes be yes and your no be no, lest you fall into judgment. Are there any farmers in here? Real farmers. Those who have waited on the crop as a means of their livelihood. How about gardeners? Any of you have gardens? Those of us that have had or do garden, which I used to, but I don't anymore, you understand the concept, right? That you put something in the ground and then pretty much nothing you do makes a whole lot of difference until you get ready to harvest it. What if you were a farmer and you start, you harvest something one season, you go to market, you sell the seeds, you sell the vegetables, you sell whatever, you withhold a portion of that to get the seeds to have ready to be able to plant the next year. And then you wait for exactly the right day when the sun's going to be about right and the rain's going to be about right and all the ground is about right and all those kind of things, and you plant. And then you get somewhere down the road, and if you don't get too much sun and if you don't get too much rain and if you don't get too much wind and if the animals don't come into the property, all these things, you get a harvest, right? Is there anything that a farmer can do to speed that up? He's got extended long-range weather, and he sees that in 2 weeks, he's going to have a late-season snowstorm. But he's got about 4 weeks left on the crop. Is there anything he can do to get that crop ready in 2 weeks or in 13 days? And there's not. How difficult would that be if you were that farmer? Put yourself in that position. What are you hoping for? You're doing all this for the hope of the harvest, right? What's the harvest for a Christian? There are not going to be any crop failures in heaven. If the farmer's doing this for the hope of the harvest, what promise do we have? Because where does our harvest come in? It's going to be there, right? And it's not going to be based on It's not going to be based on the rain or the sun or anything else like that. If the farmer can be patient, we should be able to be patient also. Verse 8, don't grumble against one another. Don't be mad. Don't groan. Don't complain. James warns us especially when it comes to dealing with our kiddos. I think about or dealing with our brothers and sisters. I think about our kiddos. You know, how many times, who's on the other side of the door, by the way, in this verse? Jesus is on the other side of the door. Have we ever had one of those situations where the kids are getting on our nerves and we're starting to talk real loud, and the longer we talk, the louder we get, and our voices get raised, and then suddenly we just go walk out the back door and there's our neighbor standing right by the door? Why would I come up with an example like that? Just off the top of my head, certainly I've never done that. And so you just walk past him and you think, well, I'm sure he didn't hear me. Jesus did. And Jesus was on the other side of that door along with the neighbor. Mama said, if you can't say something good, what? Yeah, don't say anything at all. And then with the few minutes I've got left, I want to talk about Job, because James mentions Job. And the question becomes, as Christians, why do good people suffer? We do, don't we? Go back to chapter 1. What did James say was going to happen? We are going to face trials, yes? Not maybe, not if, when. And when we do, what's our attitude to be? Did the prophets escape persecution? No, they didn't. What about Elijah? What about Jeremiah? What about Ezekiel? What about Daniel? What about Jesus? And then he brings up Job. And I think it's very interesting to understand Job is the perfect example of those trials and tribulations that we face, that have nothing to do with anything that we've done. They're just there. Because God gave us free will, that free will causes things to be put into motion, and things just happen. What is it that the book of Job tells us about Job himself? He was the greatest man in all the East. He was a godly and upright man. Every day he provided sacrifices for his children because he was worried about his children might not be doing the right thing. He had 10 of them. He had thousands of animals. He had camels and oxen and all kinds of things. And he was living a good life, and he was a godly man. And one day God and Satan had a conversation. And God brought up Job to Satan, and he said, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on all the face of the earth." And Satan said, "Well, he may be your servant now, but if you let me have a crack at him, he won't be." And God said, "Go do what you want, but don't harm him." And that happened two different times, two different circumstances. There's several things to learn. There's a whole lesson there about Satan and God and the fact that Satan is not any of those omni words, and he needed permission to do this, etc., etc., which is not a part of this morning's lesson. God gave him permission, though, to go and do certain things to Job. And he did. And what did Job do? He lost his house, he lost his servants, he lost his children, and if he had grandchildren, he lost them too. Only he and his wife were left. And of course, you remember his wife that tried to get him to curse God and die, and his friends that didn't do much better. And in the 39th, 40th, and somewhere around the 40th chapter of the book of Job, there are 70 plus questions, rhetorical questions, that God asked Job. Questions like, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where do you make the wind? Do you know where the wind comes from?" Those type of things. Questions that only God, that the answer is always God. And Job, to his credit, walks to the precipice but does not sin. And what does the Scripture say about Job's life in the latter days as opposed to the early days? He blessed him more than he did in the early days. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? You have 10 children, you lose them all. And you're blessed more than you were when you had those 10 children. How much does it hurt when we lose one? Much less 10. Our whole life's taken away from us. But Job was blessed because he remained steadfast. That's what James is talking about in verses 7 through 12. That's the lesson he's trying to give to us. We don't have excuses to be angry. We don't have reasons to be able to fuss at one another. We are to be joyful through our trials and tribulations, which goes back to chapter 1 even. Satan loves chaos. He wants us to believe that pleasure and luxury are our right. And he wants us to focus on the feed trough. God wants us to learn steadfast endurance and patience. I didn't get to verse 12. That's okay. I'll pick it up next week. And we'll have what next week will be our last lesson on James. It's my favorite. I hope it will be yours after I get through with it. It's a lesson on prayer. Study those last few verses of James this week. You will not be disappointed in the lessons that you learn, and we'll talk about next week. So thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.